In May 2026, Secretary of Health and Human Services Robert F. Kennedy Jr. fired two members of the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. That move followed a June 2025 Supreme Court decision confirming that the Secretary has significant power over the task force. I'm Stephen Morrissey, Managing Editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, and I'm talking with Elizabeth Kaplan, a clinical instructor and director of healthcare access at the Center for Health Law and Policy Innovation at Harvard Law School. Ms. Kaplan has co-authored a perspective article about changes to the USPSTF and related policies. Ms. Kaplan, broadly, what are the responsibilities of the USPSTF and who serves on that body?
The responsibilities of the USPSTF are to review scientific literature and evidence regarding preventive services that are available for particular populations and to assess benefits and potential drawbacks of those preventive services based on the evidence and to make recommendations for individuals as to what preventive services would serve their long-term health benefits. As to who serves on the task force, these are providers with expertise in primary care, obstetrics and gynecology, preventive medicine, and I believe also in some instances, pediatrics. And they are volunteers serving in a capacity where they are appointed to serve on the task force for a period of years, but they're bringing their expertise in providing and recommending preventive services to patient populations that they serve.
And then, how did the Supreme Court's decision in Kennedy v. Braidwood Management clarify the role of these USPSTF members and the Secretary's authority over the task force and its recommendations?
So the U.S. Supreme Court was presented with a constitutional question as to whether the members of the task force are appointed and serve in their positions in a capacity that's consistent with the Appointments Clause of the U.S. Constitution. And that clause requires that principal officers of the federal government must be appointed by the president and confirmed to their positions by the Senate. And usually, when we think of principal officers, we're thinking of people such as secretaries of cabinet and people with that level of authority. So the Supreme Court was presented with the suggestion or the argument that the members of the USPSTF are unconstitutionally appointed because rather than being appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate, they are simply appointed by the Secretary of HHS without a confirmation procedure and without the president's involvement. And the argument goes that they are principal officers because they were not sufficiently supervised by another official who is appointed consistent with the process outlined in the Appointments Clause. The Supreme Court looked at that argument and concluded that, in fact, the members of the USPSTF are not principal officers under the US Constitution. They are, in fact, inferior officers because they are supervised by the Secretary of HHS, who is himself appointed consistent with the clause. And the positive effect of all this is to say that the appointment of the members of the USPSTF is constitutional, and therefore the USPSTF's recommendations can be given binding effect upon insurers, specifically through the ACA preventive care rule that requires coverage of USPSTF recommendations for people with private insurance. The downside of this, though, is that in order to reach the conclusion that the appointment of USPSTF members is constitutional, the secretary has to have significant authority over the work that they do. So, just to explain that a little bit further, the secretary has a lot of authority over the task force members in keeping with what the Supreme Court outlined, but he still has to use that authority in a way that's consistent with the role that Congress has given to him and to the task force. And through the task force's authorizing statute, as well as through the Affordable Care Act, there's a specific role given to USPSTF to consider what variety of evidence that the task force authorizing statute actually walks through what that evidence is, and to issue evidence-based recommendations after considering that evidence. And then the Affordable Care Act says, okay, what the task force has said gets a grade A or B, those services are to be given coverage by private insurers without cost sharing. And so the secretary, in my view, can't insert himself into that process and just take away the role of the USPSTF, because Congress has said, no, it's the USPSTF that is to make these decisions.
As you write in your perspective, the terms of several members of the task force expired at the end of 2025 before the two additional members were fired in May. So we're talking now in late August. What's the current state of the task force's membership, and have any of those empty positions been filled?
No, it does not appear that any of those positions have been filled. So that leaves the task force with about half its membership missing. The other important factor is that the task force also has not been allowed to meet since the summer of, or really the early spring of 2025. Their last in-person meeting was in March of 2025. And usually they meet three times per year, but every meeting since then has been postponed or canceled. And so effectively, we're in a status quo now where the task force is essentially unable to move forward with its formal work of proposing draft recommendations and then ultimately approving them.
Parenthetically, what reasons did the secretary give for the two firings?
It's been a minute since I reviewed the letters themselves, but my understanding is that those reasons were based upon concern about the task force having essentially taken on political leanings that were inconsistent with the task force's role and with the administration's policy objectives.
And then, in addition to these membership issues and the lack of meetings that you just talked about, how have the task force's procedures changed since the Braidwood decision?
Their formal procedures, as in their procedures manual that lays out how they go about their work in detail, to my knowledge, those procedures have not changed per se. However, we are essentially in a period of stasis with the task force right now, where they haven't been allowed to meet, they don't have enough members, they've also experienced staff losses, as have occurred across the federal government with the cuts that have occurred. And so, I mean, effectively, the task force's work is not currently moving forward, at least not in a public sense. And so the consequence of that is that there are four final recommendations, in fact, that have been awaiting approval since 2025 or earlier, and the task force has not been able to meet and vote to approve those. And then on top of that, there are at least 14 topics that the task force has considered for future recommendations, and work is not able to move forward on those topics either.
Despite all of that, you say in your article that the actions of the secretary and the USPSTF must still be in keeping with authorizing statutes and the Affordable Care Act. So what limits are there on the secretary's power over the task force's recommendations?
In my view, the limits of the secretary's power derive from the task force's authorizing statute and the section of the Affordable Care Act that gives binding authority to the task force's recommendations in terms of what insurers are required to cover without cost sharing. So both of those statutes envision that the task force, rather than the secretary himself, will review the evidence and issue a recommendation as to whether a preventive service shall be given a grade A or B, which is the highest grade that the task force allots. I don't view either of those statutes as permitting the secretary to simply usurp the work of the task force entirely and himself make a recommendation as to whether a preventive service should be recommended.
So finally, what role do you see for policymakers and clinicians in protecting the ability of the USPSTF to adhere to rigorous scientific methods and to issue evidence-based recommendations?
We highlighted two points in the article, and there's a third one that I also want to draw attention to, particularly for policymakers. So at the federal level, even though the secretary has the ability to appoint members of the task force without Senate confirmation, it's still incredibly important for federal policymakers to pay attention to who the secretary ultimately appoints to fill these positions, assuming that he appoints anyone at all, because he hasn't so far, and to really call him to task if the people that he chooses are not people with appropriate expertise in preventive care and primary medicine. And they can do that through actions such as calling him to testify before them, posing questions to him about the qualifications of the people that he's chosen, And continuing to make this issue a visible priority in terms of how they conduct themselves at the hearing and how they use their sort of platforms as policymakers. Another thing that they can do, of course, this is a tall order, particularly in the very partisan environment that we're currently in, but they can pass legislation that limits or places boundaries around what he's able to do with respect to controlling the work of the task force. They can't go so far in that legislation as to take away the specific powers that the Supreme Court recognized that he has, but they can even further clarify that the task force needs to be able to do its work based upon scientific evidence and staffed by people with appropriate expertise, and that those decisions that they make are not to be driven by policy goals or priorities and more by what the scientific evidence around preventative medicine shows. And then there's actually a third point that I didn't go into in the article, but there's also a role for state policymakers to play. States have authority to regulate certain aspects of the insurance landscape, not all, but many of them. Specifically, states can regulate large group plans and individual and small plans offered through the exchanges. And states can also adopt legislation that protects access to preventive care without cost sharing for those state regulated plans. And so states can also play a role in this landscape in ensuring that people continue to have access to evidence-based preventive services.
Thank you, Ms. Kaplan.